Live from the Civic Media World Headquarters in Madison, Wisconsin, it's the Todd Albaugh Show. And now, pursuing truth wherever it may lead, here's your host, Todd Albaugh.
Good morning across the Civic Media Radio Network and streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app. I'm Todd Albaugh. It is Tuesday, November 22nd, 2022. Just about 6 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. We welcome you in along with Aaron Zommers. I'm Todd Albaugh on a Tuesday before Thanksgiving. A beautiful day here in Madison, the world headquarters of Civic Media. And it looks like shaping up like a nice day across the state of Wisconsin. According to the National Weather Service, today up in Amory, you can expect partly cloudy skies through the morning, some clearing in the afternoon, and a high near 36 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, a high near 40. And on Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy, and a high near 36. Over in Wausau, cloudy today in the morning. Then again, gradual clearing, a high of 37. On Wednesday, patchy fog tomorrow morning in Wausau. So do drive carefully until around 9 o'clock. Otherwise, mostly sunny once that fog burns off, at a high of 41. On Thanksgiving in Wausau, expect mostly cloudy skies and a high near 42. For Turkey Day, and in the RC, Richland Center, for WRCL forecast, a bit nicer down here is further south, mostly cloudy, gradual clearing in the afternoon, and a high near 46 today in the RC. Tomorrow, Wednesday, sunny, a high near 50, half of 100, and Thanksgiving Day, a 20% chance of a rain shower. Afternoon, cloudy, a high near 48. So down here in the balmy RC in Point South, a little bit nicer, but really nice across the state. Again, given that the weather on Thanksgiving week can be a bit dicey at times, looks like no snow or no freezing rain. So that's great. People can get to where they are going. What you need to know on a Tuesday making headlines today, an Army vet, a club goer, and a drag queen teamed up to take down the Colorado Springs shooter that left 5 dead and at least 17 injured. The mayor of Colorado Springs calling all 3 heroes today. The United States could face a massive rail strike if the sides cannot agree on paid sick leave. Both sides agreed to continue negotiations into December, but this could have a major effect not only on folks that use Amtrak, but also further slowing goods to market if the rail system would shut down. President Biden in Washington, D.C., as all presidents do since Ronald Reagan, pardoned 2 turkeys at the White House yesterday. They were not Donald Trump and Mike Pence, as some people had hoped, but in fact, 2 actual turkeys named Chocolate and Chip. Joe Biden was in, as Aaron said, Uncle Joe fine form yesterday, making jokes at the White House. Sports, World Cup USA, Team USA, and Wales played the entire game, and it finished the exact same way it began, as a tie. No, not really. I just don't like ties. 1-1, your final score. It was a draw yesterday at the World Cup in Qatar, as USA and Wales tied. Also, the Bucks beat the Trailblazers 119-111, and it is Axe Week here in Wisconsin, in Madison. The University of Wisconsin Badgers take on the PJ Flexters, better known as the Minnesota Golden Gophers, at 2:30 in Camp Randall Stadium. Should be a good game. Looking forward to it. Of course, Jim Leonard hoping by the end of the week to be named the head coach, not interim, but head coach of the Wisconsin Badgers. AD Chris McIntosh posted the job late Saturday night. According to UW policy, the job has to be posted for 7 days before a decision can be made. And the final day to get applications in for prospective coaches for Wisconsin is listed as this coming Saturday. So depending upon when Chris McIntosh wants to make that decision, news could come that the interim label has been ripped off of Jim Leonard's title. As soon as, I guess, perhaps Sunday night, but more likely Sunday or Monday. Braylon Allen, star running back for Wisconsin, came out and said that he'll play for Wisconsin as long as Jimmy Leonard is his coach. Brilliant. Putting a little pressure on AD Chris McIntosh in Wisconsin, but we shall see when that decision and announcement is made. But first, Axe Week in the big game. Hopefully Wisconsin can get the axe back from the Flexters. Coming up later this hour, we have the wonderful, the talented, the effervescent Charles Franklin, Professor Charles Franklin from Marquette University Law School, coming up at the bottom of the hour. He will review his last poll, their last poll, the Marquette Law School poll, before the election, a week before it came out. We'll look back at some of those results and see how the Marquette Law School poll's predictions, not so much a prediction, but a snapshot in time, see how that lined up with actual results.
They're usually pretty accurate.
They are.
He's a smart guy.
They are. And polling gets a lot of flack these days, and some polls have been off. We'll ask Professor Franklin, why is it that the Marquette Law School poll has been more accurate than many polls out there? And we're also going to take a look from a nonpartisan standpoint, if you will, of what these numbers are showing us and what we can garner from these numbers in the polls moving ahead in future elections, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. How do these numbers affect your person that you're supporting? We'll talk to Dr. Charles Franklin at 9:30. And then at 10:30, we have our own Luke Mathers, the Director of Operations here at Civic Media and co-host of Dueling Tangents. He'll join us at 10:30 to talk about his show, to talk about Civic Media. And of course, we got to talk a little bit World Cup too, because he is an avid World Cup dude. Luke Mathers at 10:30. We'll come back and talk about the Trumpster a bit, the special indictment, and also what Bill Barr has been saying about it. All that and more. You're listening to the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show on Tuesday, November 22nd, 2022. Thanksgiving week, holiday week. Maybe you've already started traveling, like John Candy and Steve Martin in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Perhaps my favorite all-time Thanksgiving movie. If you've never seen it, dial it up this weekend. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. John Candy, the immortal John Candy, the late John Candy, but one of the funniest comedians that I ever saw, along with Steve Martin, a brilliant actor and comedian himself, as they meet in New York and try to get across to the U.S. in time for Thanksgiving, and hilarity ensues. So wherever you're going this Thanksgiving weekend, or maybe you're just staying at home, dial us up. We'll have programming for you all weekend. A special holiday edition of our show coming up on Thanksgiving Day proper. Aaron and I will be in with you to give you the first little bit in the morning via the magic of radio. And then after the first half hour, we're going to have some of the best guests. I shouldn't say best guests, but some of the coolest guests that we've had over the last week and a half, 2 weeks. Kira Sabin's segment will be replayed. Our wonderful love doctor. Or she's actually a life coach and a wonderful person that gave us some great advice on Thanksgiving and getting together with friends and relatives about setting boundaries. So Kira will be back with us in her replay on Thanksgiving Day, and another of other people. And then on Good Friday, we're going to be talking to one of our own co-hosts here on Jason, who hosts Buy Local, and we'll be talking about how you can support local retailers wherever you are at on Good Friday. Of course, we all get sucked into trying to go to those big box stores, but Jason's going to give us some tips on how we can buy locally in our community and support our friends and neighbors. So that's coming up on Good Friday. So we will not be here live necessarily, but we will have a little bit of new programming for you on both Thanksgiving and on Good Friday, and then back with you live next Monday. We are live with you right now, and we're going to talk just a minute or two before we bring on Charles Franklin at the bottom of the hour. I don't like to give the former president a lot of press, but I do think some of the things that involve him are pertinent to the news of the day, and we need to stay on top of it and need to be aware of it. So there was an article in The Hill from Washington, D.C., this morning called former acting solicitor general expects Trump to be indicted by special counsel. The former acting solicitor general, Neil Katyal, says he expects former President Trump to be indicted by a special counsel appointed by the Department of Justice to oversee two federal investigations. Katyal, who served in the Obama administration, was on Morning Joe on MSNBC yesterday and said that the DOJ investigation into Trump's handling of classified material at Mar-a-Lago is an, quote, open and shut case, unquote. There is no doubt in my mind that if I did this or you did this, we'd be in jail right now, Katyal said. We certainly wouldn't get a special master or a special counsel or the like. It would be a very easy case. It's just the identity of the person, Donald Trump, that makes it different, he added. But at the end of the day, I expect Trump will be indicted by this special counsel, unquote. Attorney General Merrick Garland last week appointed the special counsel to oversee the Mar-a-Lago case and an investigation into whether any person or entity interfered with the peaceful transfer of power during the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The special counsel is headed by Jack Smith, a longtime prosecutor who formerly served with the International Court of Justice to investigate war crimes. Katyal said that the more solid case, is the Mar-a-Lago investigation, in which Trump is under investigation for taking thousands of documents from the White House, some of which were classified and could have been held, could have held information about a foreign nation's nuclear capabilities. Trump has decried the investigation, calling it a political witch hunt, and saying in a Fox News interview last week that he would not partake in this. The last special counsel to investigate Trump was headed by Robert Mueller, who was appointed to determine if the Trump campaign team colluded with Russia to influence the results of the 2016 election. So the special counsel has been appointed by Merrick Garland. There's been some back and forth. Progressives not necessarily all happy that Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel. They say, let's just get on with it and indict the guy if there's enough evidence there. The other school of thought is that it could be seen as a conflict of interest because Merrick Garland was appointed by Joe Biden, of course, confirmed by a Democratic Senate. And so it may appear to some that there's a conflict of interest. So I think Merrick Garland is going the extra step to say, look, we have evidence, but I'm going to appoint someone who wasn't directly appointed by a Democratic president to make sure everything is kosher. I don't have a real problem with that. I think he's just dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. My only concern is let's get this going. And let's if there's going to be an indictment, if there's enough evidence there, I believe if you listen to other people, it doesn't matter what I think. But if you listen to people like this person who worked at Department of Justice, there appears to be enough evidence. So if there's enough evidence, let's get on with it. Because what I'm concerned about is once Republicans take over in the House, you just never know what could happen. And it's not just Democrats or people appointed by Democrats saying this. It is actually Donald Trump's former Republican Attorney General himself who's essentially saying this. He appeared on the morning talk show programs this Sunday, and we have a clip, I believe Aaron has it ready for us, of former Attorney General Bill Barr under former President Donald Trump. This is what Bill Barr has to say this weekend about this investigation of Donald Trump.
If the Department of Justice can show that these were indeed very sensitive documents, which I think they probably were, and also show that the president consciously was involved in misleading the department, deceiving the government, and playing games after he had received the subpoena for the documents, those are serious charges.
That's a serious crime.
I said that I personally think that they probably have the basis for legitimately indicting the president. I don't know. I'm speculating.
You're speculating, yeah.
But given what's gone on, I think they probably have the evidence that would check the box. They have the case.
And if they have it, should they?
That's a decision for...
If you were AG, would you?
I'm not going to get into that.
Do you think they will?
I think it's becoming increasingly more likely.
Attorney General, former Attorney General Bill Barr under the Trump administration, being a little cagey there. I think we have to put it in a proper context that Bill Barr himself is exploring his own run for president, the Republican nomination in 2024. But I do think it's fascinating that Trump's own attorney, former attorney general, now comes forward and basically says, yeah, you know, I think there probably was enough evidence there. Of course, he was involved. he was already gone by the time January 6th happened, but he was involved with this guy's administration. And of course, it's always interesting, you know, timing is everything in politics. So, you know, now all of a sudden Bill Barr wants to talk and say what actually happened. But the fact that, you know, Bill Barr, by all accounts, you may disagree with his politics, but Bill Barr is not a stupid person. He's an intelligent guy. And so Bill Barr is saying that, yes, there appears to be evidence there. When he says, I'm speculating, he knows. Let's be honest. So Bill Barr says, why not? You know, basically, there should be an indictment here. So my only thing in this whole Trump indictment is a special investigation. If there's going to be one, let's get it done prior to January 2nd or whatever the Republicans take over in the House of Representatives. We shall see. On the flip side, Kevin McCarthy, Republican House Minority Leader right now, incoming apparently Speaker, Republicans have chosen him to be their caucus leader in the House. However, he has to get elected on the floor of the House as Speaker. That is still somewhat of a tenuous situation in terms of finding enough votes. But let's just say for this argument that Kevin McCarthy is the incoming Speaker for Republicans in January in Congress. He has announced that they are going after Hunter Biden and his laptop like dogs to a bone. That is all they care about. Not inflation, not crime, not anything. Just Hunter Biden's laptop. And people will say, well, that seems just, you know, it's just vindictive, right? They're just trying to score points. There's another side to this, okay? The reason Republicans want to gin up Hunter Biden again and want to gin up these investigations, and there was a story out on several news agencies, CBS amongst them, AP amongst them yesterday, that apparently somehow a clean, quote-unquote, clean version of Hunter Biden's laptop has now been found and come forward. All the documents on his laptop that appear to have not been tampered with, deleted, a clean version of Hunter Biden's laptop now appears. Timing, again, is very interesting. But here's the deal. Republicans want to gin up Hunter Biden's investigation so that Democrats and progressives will say, this is baloney. It's been looked at before. This is essentially, I hate to use the term witch hunt, but this is a non-credible investigation. They want Democrats and progressives to say this. This is a crazy investigation. Then Republicans are going to go on all the news shows and say, look, if Hunter Biden's investigation is crazy, so is this indictment on Donald Trump. Everything's crazy. It's gaslighting. You understand? It's a way for Republicans to get you all ginned up and confuse us. That's what they want to do. Confuse you and me. Well, you know, Republicans are they're going after Trump. Or the Republicans, rather, are going after Biden. The Democrats are going after Trump. And it's all crazy. None of it's real. None of it makes sense. It's all made up. No, it's not. That's one of the key rules out of the Republican playbook. To confuse people to the point they don't want to listen to anything and they shut it off. The key for you and me is to keep clear eyes and keep focused. And the fact is that the bipartisan January 6th committee, despite what Republicans will tell you, it was not partisan. There were two Republicans put on that committee, and Nancy Pelosi did not prevent Republicans from being on that committee. Kevin McCarthy prevented Republicans from being on that committee. So Adam Kissinger and Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, both Republicans, were on the January 6th committee. Liz Cheney was the co-chair of that committee, a Republican. And the January 6th committee very clearly has made the point, and their final report is going to show that Donald Trump was the key figure in inciting an insurrection, an attempted coup of the United States government. That is something you have to investigate. That is something real. The Hunter Biden stuff is not. And let me just say, if Hunter Biden is guilty, if there's something there, fine, prosecute him. Totally. But don't let them confuse you. Don't let them gin you up. Keep clear eyes. We'll be here to help you do that. We'll come back with Charles Franklin after this on the Todd Oliveball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Do you feel this vehicle is safe for highway travel?
Yes, I do. Yes, I really do. I believe that. I know it's not pretty to look at, but it'll get you where you want to go.
Now, you got no outside mirror.
No, we lost that.
You have no functioning gauges.
No, not a one. However, the radio still works.
Welcome back to the 10:30 hour, the 9:30 hour of the Todd Oliveball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network, wherever you are listening to us today, whether that is WRCE in Richland Center, WXCO in Wausau, WXCE in Amory, or streaming live on the Civic Media app around the world, or maybe you're listening to us now or watching us on Facebook and Twitter, where you can also catch the show live each and every day between 8 and 11. We appreciate you for joining us, and we appreciate our next guest, someone who I gotten to know over the years when I ran a coffee shop. He was so kind to be one of our coffee shop patrons, and then came in and did an actual kind of polling 101 one afternoon, which a lot of folks really, really enjoyed. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the co-head of the Marquette Law School poll each and every year. We welcome in Professor Charles Franklin. Charles, welcome in.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time. We were talking before the break, one of my favorite holiday Thanksgiving movies, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It's just hilarious. Do you have a favorite holiday or Thanksgiving movie?
You know, I've got to say our big one is still watching, Scrooge.
Yeah, absolutely.
We still like that.
Absolutely. I like the musical version with it was fantastic as well. So, it's the holiday season, and the elections are behind us now. And for you, I mean, you and your group are just going nonstop, 100 miles an hour. And then, you know, once you get that last poll in before election day, do you relax a little bit then?
Not yet. The post-election time is surprisingly busy. Just last week, I was in Milwaukee, I was in Eau Claire, and I was in Chicago.
Wow.
And that was a lot of miles through a bit of a snow, too.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, the last thing I've got on the calendar, at least, is the first Friday in December. And after that, I'm going to a cabin in the woods somewhere. I don't know where, but I'm going somewhere.
That's fantastic. Good for you. Well, you deserve it. For those who might be listening, I can't imagine anybody who hasn't heard of you or the Marquette Law School poll. But for those of you who may not have heard it, the Marquette Law School poll has been going on since when, Charles?
2012. We started in January of 2012. We've just finished our 74th survey of Wisconsin. Plus, we do national polls every two months. And we're in the field with a national poll right now that'll be out the week after Thanksgiving.
Wow, amazing! And you have been the co-director or head of this ever since the beginning, correct?
Yep. Enjoy doing it. The law school and the alumni who fund it. This is funded through annual contributions to the alumni fund. It's not a single check from any donor or anything like that, but the accumulated funds that alumni give the law school, those monies pay for our legal clinics for the poor, which includes a mobile legal clinic. You know, normally if a bus full of lawyers pulls up in front of your house, that's not a good thing. But in this case, it's the way the law school gets our students and associated lawyers to go out in the community and help. Also pays for summer internships for law students so they can work in nonprofits over the summer. Mm-hmm. And it also is enough to fund the poll.
I think that's a really important point because so many polls that we see during election season are funded by partisan groups. And so they kind of have a stake in that. And as you know, and some of our listeners might not understand, you can a pollster can ask questions in certain ways in a leading sort of way to kind of make the answers come back in a way that's favorable to the people who are paying for the poll. So I think it's important for people to understand with the Marquette Law School poll, that's not the case. The case here is not to create a partisan lean or an idea, but to truly get a sense of where people are really at, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And if you look at the questions that we ask, you'll find that they're about as flat as I know how to ask them. We try not to use very strong adjectives in describing anything. Now, people are still unhappy with the way I ask questions, and I got to say that up front. But over the years, I think it's more because the question doesn't represent their point of view in the question. And so and this is utterly bipartisan. If I haven't included the arguments for their side of the issue in the question, they feel like that's not an adequate representation of the issue. An example was a few years ago. Remember, we were debating an iron mine up north. Mm-hmm. And I had a question. You know, some people say it'll provide needed jobs. Others say it'll be a threat to the environment. What do you think? Should we fund it or not? And I had someone come in and very unhappy because I had not listed four different things that the mine was going to do. And a few weeks later, one interest group, an environmental interest group, ran a poll, and they did list three: arsenic, lead, and mercury that would come from the mine. Uh-huh. And WEC ran a similar poll that listed three economic benefits in their question. And that I've loved it ever since because it really does encapsulate the difference between my trying to balance the question but not provide a whole lot of specifics, right, let the voter decide, versus here are two opposite interest groups that from their point of view were absolutely reporting their perceived damages or benefits from the mine, but in their cases resulted in very unbalanced questions. The most interesting thing is with those very unbalanced questions, each of them moved opinion by no more than about 15 or 20 points in their direction. So it didn't in fact produce huge majorities for either side. And they were only modestly different than the results I got. And so that was sort of encouraging about what are the extent to which the question wording can really drive the answer.
Surprise, surprise, the way you asked it is pretty much right down the middle, and it got probably the most accurate result of where people were at. One of the other things we hear a lot about and press likes to pick up on it is, oh my gosh, how the pollsters got it wrong this time. How you know, the polls are because young people aren't picking up their phones as much because it's going to be harder because there's so many scam calls out there. People hang up quicker, that it's harder to get accurate polling information. You just touched on and explained part of the reason that some polls are inaccurate are because they're being done by partisan groups who are trying to get a certain result in asking questions, and they get that result the way they ask the question, but that doesn't pick up where voters actually are. So that's one reason I think that polling is off. Correct me if I'm wrong, but why do you think that talk a little bit about how close the Marquette Law School poll got this time in Wisconsin, and why you think that by and large the Marquette Law School poll has been pretty darn accurate.
Yeah, we did okay this time. In fact, pretty good. We had the governor's race tied 48-48. Evers got 3.2 percentage points more than that. And we were off on Michaels by 0.2 of a percentage point. In the Senate race, we were off on Barnes by 1.5 points and off by Johnson by 0.5. So in the Senate race, we had a 2-point margin. It's ended up being a 1-point margin. And in the governor's race, we had it tied, and it's a 3.2-point margin.
I mean, that's spectacular. And people need to remember what I think a lot of people don't understand or they don't choose to hear is when you release these, you at the top of the information, you say the plus or minus is, and if I have my notes correctly, in this last poll from October 24th to November 1st, the plus or minus was 4.6 and 4.8 among likely voters, which I'll explain, Charles, what that means to the average person listening. What does that mean?
Without making it stats 101, in which case we need a longer show. Right. Basically, that is a statistic based on the sample size. And for a random sample of the size, the 800 people that we do, it means that 95% of the time that we should be within 4.8 or 4.6 percentage points of the ultimate result. And so here, if that margin of error was 4.8, it means that when we said Evers was at 48, it means he could have been at 48 minus 4.8 or 48 plus 4.8. And within that range, just randomness could plausibly produce those results. And so we beat that margin of error, which is good. When you're falling inside the margin of error, it means you've done things okay. When you fall outside the margin of error, then that's an indicator that something more than random error seemed to be at play. Maybe you didn't get enough voters for one side or for the other, or maybe there was a change in the electoral environment between the poll and the election result. And unfortunately, you don't know why you got it wrong. You just know that you were a victim of something bigger than just random chance.
So that's my point, is that if you apply that 4.6 or 4.8, let's just round it up to 5 points for the sake of doing that, and I guess that's so much, you're always careful to say, this isn't a prediction, it's a snapshot in time of where voters were at. And so if you apply that plus or minus, so let's call it five, your snapshot in time was pretty much spot on, right dead center of what voters actually did a week later.
It's pretty good. Let me put
You're
it
being
a different
modest.
Way.
It was very good.
well, I'm going to actually tell you it was average for us, because over all of the elections we've done since 2012, our average error on the margin, that is the Democratic minus the Republican margin, our average error has been to be off by 2.2 percentage points.
Wow.
That's well within that 4.8 that we're talking about. Mm. And so I'm very proud of that. That 2.2 also includes the big error in 2016, where we were off by over 6 on the governor's race, I mean, on the presidential race, and we're off by just over 4 points on the Senate race. Those are our two all-time biggest errors. So the average over all of them is 2.2 points. And this time it happens to be 2.2 points across the governor and the Senate race. So it's an average error for us, but I'm, as I say, unduly proud of the fact that a 2.2 average error is pretty good.
Pretty darn good indeed. I just think very few programs, we have the luxury of having a little bit more time here on this show. And so I think it's good for people to know the background and the story of how these polls work, particularly the Marquette Law School poll. So when they see this information, I know Channel 3 here in Madison has you on quite a bit. I know Kristen Bry and As Goes Wisconsin, our colleague, has had you on as well. And so when you take the time, and you're very generous with your time, to go on programs and explain these numbers, I think it's good for listeners to know that this isn't someone with an agenda. It's not just kind of a shot in the dark, that you take this very seriously and you're really trying to help voters understand what the climate is as we go through these election seasons.
Thanks. I appreciate that. That is, of course, what I'm trying to do. But, you know, politics is, as you may know, a fairly contentious world. And
yes,
so,
it is.
You know, people have different perspectives on it. And I think in one sense, that's fine. I have my ability to present these results and try to explain them. But other folks have their chance to say what they want to say. And so it balances out in the end.
We have about a minute and a half before our first break. We're going to come back and continue talking with Professor Charles Franklin, head of the Marquette Law School poll. Before we go to break, though, just kind of your own personal takeaway as you look at the numbers from this last poll from November 24th through November 1st. Was there anything that kind of popped out at you as like, oh, I didn't expect that, or that's very interesting?
Yeah, I think that the things we're seeing are the continued super strong polarization in this state. You know, polarization is a national phenomenon now, but Wisconsin got there first, starting in 2011 with Act 10 and the struggles over that. But it was independents that drove the swings in this election from August through Election Day, starting out leaning pretty solidly Democratic, shifting in a Republican direction, and then coming back to near parity at the end, helping tip the governor's race one way and the Senate race the other.
Very interesting. Professor Charles Franklin, he's going to stay with us. He'll be back with us after the break. We're going to look at the issue of education and public education, how that played out in the last poll compared to the election results. We'll be back with more. You're listening to the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Some facts and figures from the Marquette Law School poll, the Todd Allball Show, for a Tuesday, the 22nd of November, 2022. It is around 9:50 in the morning. We are joined this half hour by our fine guest, Professor Charles Franklin, Professor Emeritus from UW-Madison and head or co-head of the Marquette Law School poll. And before the break, we started talking a little bit. The last poll that you folks did October 24th through November 1st before the election, the thing that I thought was fascinating, Charles, and we had Dr. Jill Underley, state school superintendent, on this program last week. And I know you're a nonpartisan group, and you're not taking a partisan bent on this. I'm not trying to get you to be a partisan, but I think just from a statistical standpoint, from looking at the polling data, I think you can speak to it. I'd be interested to know. I'm just going to give a couple of figures here that I found interesting on public education. So I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, on the issues, when you asked all voters what their number one issue was, number one was inflation. 68% were very concerned about that. But the number two issue was public schools at 62%. And then if you break that down further, for Democrats, it was the one, two, three, four, the fifth. The third highest issue. Democrats said 62% of respondents said public schools was their number one issue. But here was the kicker. And you talked about this, that independents had a big effect in this election. Amongst independent voters, public schools was their number two issue. 64% of independent voters said public schools were their number two issue. Isn't that fascinating?
It is, and it shows, I think, a couple of things, but one most prominently is that public schools are a perennial issue. You know, what the state budget is for public schools, what the impact on property taxes is, what the impact for your kids or your grandkids, perhaps. So public schools, in that sense, is always in the background, even if it's not quite in the forefront. Now, last year in 2021, we saw public education emerge as a flashpoint in the liberal conservative debate over wokeness and about public education, what's being taught in schools. That was especially true in the Virginia governor's race in 2021. But we saw it here in Wisconsin with some attempts to recall school board members in Menominee, for example, all of which failed in that case. But we have seen it become more of a flashpoint in the spring elections last year than it had been. Now, it sort of got pushed to the background of the governor's debate, but certainly funding of public education, funding of voucher schools with public money is going to be an issue in the legislative session this spring, and would have been even more so had Tim Michaels won the governorship.
Just from a statistical correlation point of view, I don't have a sheet in front of me right now, but we talked about this with Dr. Underley. I think, memory serves, there were 81 different public school referendums on the ballot across the state of Wisconsin this November. And I believe all but 16 or so passed. It was an overwhelming amount. And these were not in most cases. Like Monroe School District, $88 million to build a new high school, passed. Smaller municipalities like Hillsboro, close to Richland Center and Reedsburg, passed a $3 or $4 million referendum. My thinking is that so many people, these smaller towns, the association with their public school is their town. And I think that these school referendums brought people out to the polls, and they were more inclined to vote for the candidate that they thought was pro-public education. Do you agree or disagree?
I think so, though I'm not going to go to the latter point about whether it brought them out and voted for the pro-education candidate. It may have, but in a mix of all the other issues. But I wanted to emphasize the success of referenda in school votes. Over the last several years, it seems really clear that within towns, the stresses on public education funding, the challenges of state aid not keeping up with the needs of schools, that's a big issue in the coming legislative session. It's a big issue for those school districts. And one of the things we've seen in our polling, because we've asked a lot about education over the last year, with the idea that next year's budget, no matter who won the election, next year's budget is going to be really critical for schools. And the thing we see is that across the state, over 60% say they're satisfied or very satisfied with their local public schools. That is lower in Milwaukee and in the Milwaukee area, in Racine specifically. But around the state, people are very satisfied with their public schools. And so threats to those schools are taken pretty seriously. And I think especially when you get into the rural areas of the state where school consolidation has been a really big deal. And the possibility that, you know, you may lose your local high school or your local elementary school. You may not be able to field a football team. Those are serious things in big parts of our state, and it shows that there's support for public schools, even in areas that may vote for Republicans otherwise, who tend to be critical of public schools in favor of voucher schools. But that's a part of the education debate. How do we preserve rural schools, and how do we adequately finance schools anywhere in the state? And, you know, there is also demand, especially on the Republican side, for vouchers, for people to have the opportunity to choose private schools with state support. So this is a hot issue. That's why it ranks so highly among the issues we asked about, is because just about everybody has some level of concern about it.
I just thought it was fascinating that it ranks so highly with independents, but across the board as a number two issue overall. But what did you see the advertisements on was crime, gun violence, all these things that ranked lower. So I know you're not in the business of giving political advice, but I am was. And I just thought if I was a political consultant, I'm like, boy, I would have pounded public education. But we have about 2 minutes left, Charles. I wanted to get a quick take on shifting patterns, particularly we call them the wild counties around Milwaukee. What have you seen there? It's kind of the 30,000 foot view level.
Yeah, the Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties have been drifting away from the Republican Party. They're still majority Republican, but they are substantially less solidly so than they were. The net Republican vote there, Republican minus Democratic votes, has dropped by about 40,000 votes from 4 years ago. And that itself was down from 4 years before that. And so Tim Michaels got, I believe it's 59% out of Waukesha County, a place where Republicans used to get 70% of the vote. And so in statewide races, this is a big effect that the single largest bastion of Republican votes has been drifting away. And that's not just one race. It's true of the presidential races, but it's also true of Scott Walker's vote dropping off in 2018 there. Now Tim Michaels dropping further. Ron Johnson's vote falling compared to where it was six years ago.
That's fascinating, Charles. I appreciate it. Sorry to cut you off. We got to go, but thanks for being with us, Charles Franklin. More after this on the Todd Hallball Show.